Guardian Unlimited.
Hello, it's Friday, October the 20th, and it's John Dennis here with News Desk from Guardian Unlimited. Today, Tony Blair meets other European leaders in Finland. He's made his strongest call yet for urgent action to tackle climate change, and their special guest tonight is Vladimir Putin, the Russian president. Nurses aren't happy with the pay offer the government's put on the table. They say it amounts to a pay cut, and they're holding Gordon Brown responsible. You'll hear from our reporter in Tehran, where there's been a big rally against Israel. And also today, making things invisible might seem a tad far-fetched, but scientists say it might just happen. And some cast iron figures by the sculptor Anthony Gormley are going to disappear from a beach on Merseyside after a decision by local councillors. Yo, Cameron, quit pimping the poor. That was the message the leader of the Conservative Party got yesterday when he met a rapper from Chicago. And Roz Taylor's in the hood. I suspect I'm the first person ever to have said that. And she's going to be having a look at some of the other stories in today's papers. Global warming and relations with Russia are the main items on the agenda today at a summit of European Union leaders. Nicholas Watts, our Europe editor, and he's in Lahti in Finland. I ask him to tell us about the letter that Tony Blair and the Dutch Prime Minister Jan-Peter Balkenende have sent to the other EU leaders.
Last night from the Prime Minister, a joint letter that he wrote with his Dutch counterpart Jan-Peter Balkenende. And essentially the two Prime Ministers are saying that we've really got 15 years to go to deal with global warming. And if we don't do that, if we don't take immediate action, then there are going to be, as he said, catastrophic consequences within the next 10 to 15 years. And it really recognises that when Britain held the presidency of the EU this time last year, and it held that informal summit at Hampton Court, it's a recognition by the British government that the Prime Minister didn't really do enough about climate change, to put climate change at the top of the agenda.
And will this letter that he's written with his Dutch counterpart make any difference?
Well, I think all sides in Europe, and possibly even in the United States, and indeed in China, that booming economy in Asia, which is obviously demanding vast amounts of energy, are waking up to the danger of climate change. I think the atmosphere is changing, and I would imagine that there will be agreement with that letter from the Prime Minister at today's summit. But will they do anything about it? Well, the main point of this summit is really to meet the challenge of globalisation and also to talk about Europe's energy supplies, which is why Mr. Gas, Vladimir Putin, is here today. And it's a difficult one. On the one hand, we've got to meet the challenge of globalisation. We've got to meet the challenge from China and India. And what does that mean? Well, that means growing our economies. What does that mean? That means more energy.
How will European leaders aim to persuade Vladimir Putin to guarantee steady supplies of oil and gas?
Russia prides itself that it has always and will always guarantee the security of supply of oil and gas. And they point out that at the height of the Cold War, when it was the Soviet Union supplying that gas and oil, that supplies always came through. There was that hiccup in January when Russia cut off supplies to Ukraine, and that hit supplies to Europe. But Russia says that's not our fault. That's basically because the Ukrainians, who weren't getting any gas, nicked a bit of your gas. But there is certainly nervousness about that security, and there's also nervousness about the stability of Russia, about whether Putin is committed to democracy, and also the way that the state control of gas supplies in Russia do not allow any European countries really to get in there. And what the Europeans are saying to Russia is, look, we are your great client. We are your great customer. We buy most of your gas. You've now, quid pro quo, got to allow us to have a foothold, toehold in your market.
Will European leaders be able to present a united front when they meet Vladimir Putin?
Well, a lot of diplomats are dreading the dinner tonight because they think that divisions within Europe will be exposed. On the one hand, you've got the former communist countries like Poland, the Baltic states, who have not forgot their membership of the Warsaw Pact. In the case of the Baltic states, they were actually members of the Soviet Union. They've not forgotten that. And they won't think twice about criticizing Russia. Other countries, most notably Germany, which has just signed a very lucrative, a very favourable deal for the supply of gas, they perhaps want to pull their punches. The idea is that the European leaders meet amongst themselves over lunch today, work out a common line, and then Putin pitches up for dinner this evening in the Sibelius Hall, and they have an agreed front. I'm not quite sure it's going to work like that. And let us not forget Putin. He made his name as a KGB spy in East Berlin. He knows how to play the Europeans beautifully.
What about the food, Nick? Because Jacques Chirac, the French president, said that Finnish food was the worst in Europe, even worse than Britain's.
Well, the Finns Jean-Jacques Chirac said that. He does have a way, doesn't he, of offending virtually everybody. But it has to be said that the Finns are making an effort with their food. There was a trip to Finland at the start of their presidency, way back at the end of June, beginning of July. I went on that trip and they made a real effort with their food. And I can say it was pretty impressive. Okay, it's not French cuisine, it's not Italian, we accept that. But it's not bad.
As long as you're eating well, we're all happy. Thanks very much, Nick. Now, Ros Taylor's here with a look at today's papers. Ros, there's more evidence, really, of a possible turning point in the US occupation of Iraq.
Yeah, I think this will come to be seen as a real turning point in the view of the Bush administration. What we're seeing here, I mean, you heard yesterday on the podcast George Bush comparing, albeit tentatively, aspects of what's going on in Iraq to the Tet Offensive in Vietnam in 1968. But we're not just getting that today. In the Herald Tribune today, we're getting very strong stuff saying, you know, the security plan, the aim to get out of the big cities has failed. We need not just new tactics, but a new strategy. And it also says that behind the scenes, an entire study group, a commission, is working on ways to extract what the Herald Tribune calls redefining victory, trying to find a face-saving way out for George Bush at this point. And of course, the midterm elections coming up as well next month. And a general in Iraq tells the paper that it's a possibility that the insurgents are timing their worst attacks to try and affect the midterms. But whether that is true or not, you might want to take that with a pinch of salt. Certainly, things are getting a lot worse quite quickly.
What's David Cameron said about this policy commission's recommendations on tax cuts?
Well, he's basically said thanks, but no thanks. Not in so many words, but he writes an article for The Telegraph today. In which he says that the recommendations, I should point out at this point that the recommendations were come from a commission that was put in place by Michael Howard, so his predecessor, with a Thatcherite in charge. He says the recommendations are, you know, interesting, but he's not going to make any promise to cut tax at this point for the next election, although he does say that it is, you know, in every Tory wants to cut taxes in the end, but it's not right to commit ourselves now.
The Anglo-Dutch steelmaker Corus looks like it's going to be bought up by an Indian company.
Yes, in fact, it turns out they've accepted the bid today, 455 pence a share, which is much higher than what Corus was worth back in 2003, just 19p. This is actually the biggest takeover of a Western business by an Indian company, Tata Steel.
And I mean, not perhaps the best subject for an audio programme, but it's quite a funny story in the Mirror about this. It's a wife who's painted her house an unpleasant colour, really. In essence, that's the story, isn't it?
Yeah, you have to be fair, you have to see the paper to realise just how awful a colour is. But Beryl Murray, who lives in Northumberland, decided while her husband was away on a business trip that she would cover over the pebble dash on the front of their semi and would paint it an exceedingly bright yellow. And it's hard to convey just how bright this yellow is. It's not a colour found in nature, not even on a daffodil. And she's pictured holding the paintbrush and saying, it wasn't supposed to be that bright, but my husband knows what I'm like. And although it was a bit of a shock, it's grown on him now.
Ros, many thanks. And if you like Ros's style, and I think you do, you can read a review of the papers by Ros very often by signing up to our daily email at guardian.co.uk/wrap. A team of scientists from Britain and America believe they're a step closer to inventing a device that would make objects vanish from sight. So, the big question for our science correspondent, Ian Sample, is whether this is really, as the scientists claim, the world's first invisibility cloak.
It is, but the very first thing to say about this is it's not optically invisible. It's invisible to microwaves. But what these guys are saying is they're saying, OK, we've done it with the really easy stuff. Microwaves are like 3 centimetres long. They're quite big. Normal stuff, normal vision, the light that we see is a lot smaller. So this was a proof of principle, but they think they can do it in the optical. It's a lot more complicated doing it to make it visually disappear, but they've proved that they can do it.
But in what sense is it invisible? I mean, if we can see it, you know, to the layman, it seems a bit not invisible, frankly.
OK, what they've done is they've shown that by encasing something in this special structure called metamaterials, incoming electromagnetic radiation, which in this case was microwaves but could later be visible light, hits it and is bent around it and then goes out the other side as if it wasn't there. And as far as an observer would be concerned, you wouldn't be able to see it.
How have they made this work? I mean, it seems incredibly complex.
It is incredibly complicated. Basically, you have a concentric rings of these materials they call metamaterials, and what they do is they change refractive index all the way through them. So what it does is actually works a bit like the way a mirage is created, and it bends light, well, it would bend light hopefully in the future, but at the moment it bends microwaves around an object that's put in the middle of this structure, and then out the other side it carries on as if the object had never been there. So it's incredibly detailed and complicated structures that they've created, and to miniaturize it to make it work for optical frequencies would be a really hard task. That's a long way in the future. But what they're going to use this for is for stealth technology, for making planes disappear on radar, more so than they do already.
What are the similarities between the way that microwaves work and the way that light works?
Exactly the same. It's just that light is shorter. The microwaves in this experiment are about 3 centimetres long. That's how long they are, about 10 gigahertz. Light frequencies are much shorter than that. And it's all just electromagnetic radiation. So if you prove it in one thing, in one bunch of frequencies, it should work in another.
And how far are we away from a invisibility cloak of the sort that you might read about in science fiction books?
It's a lot to do. They know that they can get the theory to work. It's a matter of just doing some incredibly smart and incredibly fine-scale engineering. There's probably some pretty serious tweaks they need to do to some of the theory as well to get that to work. But they all of them think it will happen.
Ministers want to peg next year's pay rise for nurses to 1.5%. Well, inflation is 3.6%, so nurses' leaders say that amounts to a pay cut. John Carville's our social affairs editor. I asked him why the National Health Service is short of cash.
The NHS isn't short of cash. It's had shed loads of cash poured into it consistently for the last 3 or 4 years, and that pouring exercise carries on until March 2008. So it's not short of cash, but it desperately needs to control one or two problems. Actually, there's more than one or two problems. There's scores of problem areas where, in spite of the extra cash, they've run into big deficits.
And how's that happened?
It's happened partly through poor management planning, partly through the fact that the priority they were given by the government was that at all costs they must bring the waiting list down. In the old days, a hospital that was running into financial difficulty would have just eased off a bit, sent the doctors home early. They would have stopped spending quite so much money. There was an absolute imperative by the end of last year to have got the waiting list down to 6 months. And frankly, many of them kept their foot on the accelerator to achieve that destination and ran out of petrol.
So they're having to tighten their belts. What's the government's position on nurses' pay?
Very tough indeed. I mean, what we had yesterday was an announcement that the recommendation into the independent pay review body that governs these matters should be an annual increase of only 1.5%. Now, that is a lot less than the prevailing inflation rate. I think it was 3.7% in the latest RPI. And the nursing unions are hopping mad.
What have they said?
They've said it's effectively a 2% pay cut, because when you've taken account of inflation, that's what the numbers suggest. And they've suggested that the government is bullying the pay review body by saying that if it isn't tight this year, then there'll have to be more job losses and operations cancelled and staff laid off.
Patricia Hewitt, the health secretary, indicated that she thought hospitals were going to be able to afford a bigger pay rise, but the health unions have detected the hand of Gordon Brown in deciding on the government's position.
I think that's right. Frankly, I don't know Patricia Hewitt's exact position. I don't know the number she was arguing for, but I have heard from well-placed sources that she was arguing for more than the 1.5%. In that sense, it is Gordon Brown's doing. He has made it tougher, maybe a little bit tougher, maybe a lot tougher than the Department of Health thought was possible.
How much would it cost to give the nurses a bit more money?
Oh, now, I think an extra 0.5%, if I'm remembering it rightly, is £170 million. And there are all sorts of numbers that the government has given, suggesting how many nursing jobs, how many elective operations could be done for that money. So it is such a huge organisation that a tiny percentage increase can have a vast impact.
And are there job cuts on the horizon as well?
There's a big row going on at the moment about the job cuts. Some people say there are 20,000 people who are going to lose their jobs. Now, actually, that's wrong. The position is that around about 20,000 posts will be eliminated. But it's not the same thing as a compulsory redundancy. I think there we're talking about 600 or 700 or 800.
And what other issues are the health unions unhappy about at the moment?
They're unhappy about the whole drift of government policy, what they call privatisation, what the government would call contracting out of big services, and the biggest of those is the supply of everything from chicken legs to bandages. That is something which the unions are deeply worried about. Unison led the charge at the Labour Party conference. The government's position was comprehensively defeated, but that won't make a blind bit of difference. And, of course, the unions are concerned about the more competitive nature of the NHS, not just hospitals competing against private clinics, but competing with each other. The government is introducing this system to provide a spur to efficiency and consumer-friendly behaviour, but the unions think that actually the public service should be about serving the public and not competing with each other.
Join the army airborne, got his uniform, went to boot camp, got some discipline, I rock this when they shipping him. He's in the midst of war, bullets flying and missing him, wishing he was a kid again with his family in Michigan. In the midst of fighting militiamen, one round, took down six of them. He ain't really a killer though, taking a lot of risk. This is what a poor person do for a scholarship then. He turned around and got a face full of hollow tips. But don't be mad, he died for the flag.
That's Rhymefest, a rapper from Chicago, whose real name is Shay Smith. And Rhymefest performed that song called Bullet for David Cameron yesterday when he visited the Tory leader at the Houses of Parliament to talk about violent lyrics in rap songs. Enough respect, The Guardian's reporter Esther Adley.
Well, he had a meeting with a rapper called Rhymefest, who is a rapper from Chicago and a collaborator with Kanye West, actually quite a well-regarded, highly respected rapper. And in fairness to David Cameron, who has been accused by a number of people of staging a publicity stunt, it was Rhymefest who approached him and asked for the meeting after Mr. Cameron made some comments earlier this year that rap music, particularly played by Tim Westwood on Radio 1, contributed to encouraging young people to carry guns and knives. So they met, had a cup of tea, the rapper's request, and came to an understanding, as Rhymefest put it, after the meeting.
And why did Rhymefest contact Cameron in the first place?
Well, if you listen to Rhymefest's music, and I'm not an expert, but he has quite an explicit political agenda with some of his tracks, and he talks about how politicians need to take responsibility for their policies in contributing to poverty, specifically with communities where guns and violence are a problem, and obviously in many cases those are the same communities that rap music is coming from.
Was it just a listening exercise for Cameron, or did he have a message for Rhymefest?
Well, they shared views, and one would have to ask David Cameron what he learned from the meeting. Rhymefest said that it was a very positive meeting. David Cameron revealed that he was a fan of hip-hop, which he hasn't admitted to in the past. He said that he likes the Arctic Monkeys, of course, all politicians do. But he said that he liked Stan by Eminem because he liked the message in it.
And do you think that Cameron was wise to have had this meeting?
Well, it's interesting. It's quite a tricky thing for politicians to do, to meet with a rapper. David Cameron, obviously not shy in standing in front of a camera when he believes that there's a photo opportunity that might benefit his image. Having said that, he was very careful not to be photographed with Rhymefest yesterday because these things can backfire. He would argue that this is an important part of his brief to understand kind of young people, particularly disadvantaged young people, and I suspect he would say that, well, he did say yesterday in a statement that it was an extremely positive thing and they hope to work together on projects to tackle some of the exclusion among young people.
Another Place is the title of a work by the sculptor Anthony Gormley. It's 100 cast-iron naked men distributed about a two-mile stretch of coastline at Crosby near Liverpool. The original idea was to keep them there for 16 months and then to move them to New York. But there's been a campaign to keep them there. And now the local authority says they've got to go. I asked The Guardian's David Ward to describe them.
Well, they're all him. They are cast iron figures based on moulds of his own body. There's 100 of them spread out along 3 kilometres of the beach at Crosby, which is just north of Liverpool. But the public have really taken to them since they were installed in July last year. And one of the fascinating things is just to watch people relating to them.
And Crosby's not one of nature's traditional beauty spots, is it?
Well, the beach is wonderful. It's a beautiful, long, sandy beach which leads up to Formby and their sort of World Heritage dunes. But people have walked along it and used it as a recreation area because, I mean, places like Bootle are just down the road. The point was that they got planning permission, and they had planning permission until November this year. The group that kind of promoted them, taking into account this kind of public support, decided it would be a good idea to try and keep them. And one of the things they did was to go back to the planning committee and say, can we delay removing them from November till next spring, simply because it will be safer? But that was partly a move to give them time to find the money to keep them. Next week, ministers were about to announce £1 million grant towards costs of about £2.2 million involved in buying them and maintaining them. And just as they were about to announce that, the planning committee met last night and said, on health and safety grounds, we want them removed. That so many people want them, and the arguments for the other side are that the sea anglers and the surfers were very worried. I mean, one of the sea anglers actually said he thought that each of these 100 figures should have a red navigation light on his head. Gormley himself is not particularly impressed. I mean, I've just been speaking to him, and he said to me that there is no logic to this other than small minds in some grey zone of human experience wanting to deny the unusual. A bit of kicking sand in somebody's face, I think, really. But it is a great shame, and I think one of the real dangers is this, even though it's Sefton, nothing to do with Liverpool. Liverpool has been using the figures to promote its Capital of Culture year in 2008 on posters, which you see in London mainline stations and I think on the Tube too. And so they'll probably have to take those posters down, and the danger is that it'll be seen as another Liverpool Capital of Culture cock-up.
Iranians have been attending a big rally in their capital, Tehran, today to mark Quds Day, or Jerusalem Day, when they're encouraged to demonstrate in support of the Palestinians. President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was there, as was The Guardian's Robert Tate. And apologies for the sound quality here, but he is in Tehran talking on his mobile.
Today is Quds Day in Tehran, and this is an annual event in the Islamic Republic. It's been taking place since the revolution in 1979. It takes place every year, and the leaders of the Republic try to rally support for their call for the abolition of the State of Israel. The atmosphere this year is very much that of a carnival, and there are many children milling around, many of them carrying balloons. And there are also there are poster displays, there are cartoon displays, one of which satirizes the Holocaust. Another interesting development is that there's a booth at which young children can hand in paintings of their depictions of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Some of these children are as young as 11, and in return for these paintings, they're given a T-shirt from Tehran to the council. Some of the kids are really quite fervent.
And President Ahmadinejad has been addressing the crowd.
He has. He was his usual confrontation on combative self, and there's plenty of the speech which will cause offence and provocation. He started off by poking fun at the Zionist lobby in the United States, and he was mocking their attempts to demonstrate against him in his recent trip to New York when he addressed the UN General Assembly. He said they were unable to rustle up more than a few hundred demonstrators and couldn't even organize a bus tour to get them in. And it was so pathetic, he said, that even the American pro-Zionist news networks didn't bother to cover it. And they contrasted that with the enormous showing that's turned out here in Tehran today.
And has he had an enthusiastic reception from the crowd?
From some of them. I think many of them have not been paying that much attention because they've been too busy enjoying the day.
That's Robert Tate. In Wednesday's edition of News Desk, we heard Tom York say why he's considering stopping touring because of the carbon emissions rock bands produce when they're on the road. Well, one listener, Jeremy Hayes, posted a comment at blogs.guardian.co.uk/podcasts. You could have also sent us an email, podcasts@guardian.co.uk, or on Skype left a voice message by dialing GU_studio. Anyway, he says, Radiohead to stop touring, no loss, saw them at Zsiget Musical Festival in Budapest last August, and they were terrible live. But another listener, Frutian, says, I saw Radiohead at Zsiget too, and I thought they were brilliant. So, this week on News Desk, we've discussed Iraq policy, the threat from Al-Qaeda and tax policy. But what you really like talking about on the blog is whether Radiohead were any good in a concert in Hungary. Well, some more comments on the blog for yesterday's show, when our technology correspondent Bobby Johnson explained why music fans might want to buy Keane's new single in a new format, the Memory Stick. A listener, Nottingham Florist, says, "Is having a screensaver of Keane really a technological advantage?" Good point, well made. And Bobby's praised by a listener called himself Brian Robson's liver for his use of the word gubbins. Well, these technical terms go right over my head, I'm afraid. Today's show is produced by Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey. I'm John Dennis. Have a nice weekend.
Guardian Unlimited.